Institute this afternoon. I will be talking about structure beyond the horizon, in particular as a way to create the observed power asymmetry in the CMB during inflation. And this is work I've done with Mark and Sean at Caltech. And all the details can be found in two preprints up on the archive. So a quick outline of what I'm going to be talking about. First, I'll discuss what is the power asymmetry and why do we think it's there. And now that we maybe accept that it's there, how do we go about making one? And that'll lead to a bit of a segue, because we'll have to wonder about superhorizon perturbations in the CMB and how you go about observing superhorizon perturbations in the CMB. And that will give us some bad news, which will force us to consider an alternative theory of inflation, the curvaton model, and how it's going to solve all of our problems. And I'll also give a quick review of what the curvaton model of inflation is. And finally, I'll talk about our prize model here, a power asymmetry from the curvaton during inflation. And does it work? Does it meet all existing constraints? And how can we test it? As Naishir mentioned, this will be a theory that we will know in less than 5 years whether or not this can work. So what do I mean by hemispherical power asymmetry? What I mean is take the CMB temperature and treat it as a Gaussian field with isotropic power, just like we always consider, and modulate it with some modulation amplitude and some dipolar structure. So the modulation amplitude, this term here, looks something like this on the full sky. And what that does is it takes an isotropic simulated map, this is with A equals 0, and turns it into something that's very asymmetric, so that you have more fluctuation amplitude on one side of the sky than the other. Now, we've all seen maps of the CMB from WMAP, and we know it doesn't look like this. But this is a really, really big asymmetry. This is 50% asymmetry. What if the asymmetry were only 10%? Then it becomes much more difficult to discern with the naked eye. You'd really have to squint and convince yourself that, yeah, maybe there is a little more extreme fluctuation in this side than that side. But a statistical analysis would be required to extract that. So this means that there is an open question. Is our universe, is our WMAP sky isotropic or asymmetric? What is the amplitude of the modulation, if there is one, and what direction does it point? And indeed, in 2004, Erickson and Hansen et al. Found a power asymmetry in the large-scale CMB. They looked basically at L between 5 and 40. And this illustrates their power asymmetry. What this shows is they divided the sky in half at several different poles. So the pole is the center of each one of these disks. And then they looked at the ratio of the average power in one half of the sky versus the other. And this shows low to high ratio. And so you can see that there's definitely kind of a dipolar structure that's maximized when the pole is here. Additionally, they looked at, in these little disks, which ones had abnormally high power, i.e. more power than 80% of Gaussian realizations, and which disks had less power. And the abnormally high power, you can see, are definitely clustered in one side of the sky, as opposed to the low power is clustered in the other side of the sky.
Sorry, was that seen in Kobe as well?
Yes, it is. It's at less significance because of Kobe's error bars, but it was seen in Kobe. And so, like I pointed out, you've got less power on this side, more power on this side. The power asymmetry is maximized when the equatorial plane between the two hemispheres is significantly tilted relative to the galactic plane. And less than 1% of simulated maps, simulated symmetric maps, contain a hemisphere split this extreme.
But this kind of effect is different from the kind you mentioned in the last slide, isn't it? Because that one is just the exact dipole. This is the subtracting.
Right. This was the original analysis that first found this. When they redid it for WMAP3, they looked more in the exact form I was talking about before. So in the WMAP3 data, the same team looked for this asymmetry again, and this time they did a Bayesian analysis using the exact formalism that I described before. That was just, they were dividing the sky in half and looking at power on one side, just pretty much analyzing two halves of the sky as independent skies, and looking at an average power spectrum on one side versus the other, and looking at ratios between the two. For the WNF3 data, they went to a Bayesian analysis trying to determine the most likely value for A. And what they found is showed here, here's the likelihood function as a function of A, and it's for two different sky cuts and three different frequencies. And you can see that the likelihood is not peaked at zero, but rather at about 0.12, about 12% modulation. And the probability of measuring this amplitude or larger given an isotropic field is, again, about 1%. So this is a 99% confidence level detection. So what could this asymmetry be? Well, it's difficult to explain with foregrounds because, as you can see here, it's present in all colors. So if there was some kind of foreground emission, you'd expect there to be some frequency dependence here, and there's definitely not. It's also not aligned with the galaxy, as I mentioned before, which you'd expect a foreground to be. And as Justin already asked, it was seen with COBE, albeit at less statistical significance because of the greater air bars. So that makes it difficult to explain with WMAP systematics. So we set out to try to come up with a mechanism to create an asymmetry like this. And the mechanism that we wanted to try rested on the idea that in normal inflation, you have a homogeneous inflaton that gets little quantum fluctuations. And so if we're here and we're looking out at the edge of our observable universe, on opposite sides of the sky, we see fluctuation amplitudes that are about the same. But if you look at the power spectrum in potential fluctuations, and when I say potential here, I'm just talking about a normal conformal Newtonian metric with no anisotropic stress. When you look at the potential fluctuations, they depend on the background value of phi. So our idea was, what if we introduced a super horizon fluctuation that effectively made the mean value of the inflaton field different on one side of the sky versus the other? That would change the amplitude of the fluctuations in those two respective backgrounds. So we nicknamed this large amplitude super horizon fluctuation the supermode. Now, we need to explain a modulation amplitude of 12%. That translates into a power asymmetry of plus or minus 20%. So that's actually really large. And generating this much asymmetry is going to require a really big super horizon perturbation for two main reasons. One, perturbations with different wavelengths are very weakly coupled in standard inflation models. And another way of seeing this is that the fluctuation power is not very sensitive to the background value of the inflaton field. This is what gives our spectral index so close to flat. So if you look at how the power depends on the background field, you find that, yes, indeed, the power asymmetry you get from introducing a variation in phi across the observable universe is suppressed by 1 minus n sub s. So it's really small. And since this inflaton perturbation is going to give directly a potential perturbation, which would source temperature fluctuations in the CMB, you would think that surely the resulting temperature dipole would be far too large to let this model work. If the inflaton really were much higher on one side of the sky than the other, then we should see a big dipole in the CMB, much bigger than is observed. This leads me to my segue to part two. We've got to think about super horizon perturbations and the cosmic microwave background. How do we look for these things? Remember I mentioned that dipole. Well, the dipole is actually a finicky creature. It sometimes cancels. This has been known since the pioneering work of Grishkuk and Zeldovich in 1978. In an Einstein de Sitter universe with only matter, a super horizon perturbation induces no CMB dipole. And the way that works is if you treat your super horizon perturbation as just a linear gradient across the sky with some fixed amplitude, the Sachs-Wolf dipole is just 1/3 the potential. And so that just means that the photons that have to climb out of the well get redshifted, the photons falling out get blue shifted. But you also have a Doppler dipole, because we are falling down the exact same potential well. And when you look at the Doppler dipole, It's our velocity relative to the photons at surface of last scattering. And since Einstein de Sitter is all nice and analytic, you have a nice simple expression for the velocity. And you have a nice simple expression for the co-moving distance. And when you rewrite the dipole from the Doppler effect, you get a nice cancellation. And in the end, the 2's cancel, these factors cancel, and you're just left with minus 1/3. And so the Sachs-Wolfe dipole is exactly canceled by the Doppler dipole in an Einstein de Sitter universe. And since psi is constant in an Einstein de Sitter universe, there's no ISW effect to mess things up. So that's really nice, but it kind of looked like a mathematical fluke. In the literature since 1978, it's often been mentioned that, of course, this won't happen in a lambda CDM universe with radiation or anything that resembles our universe. So we set out to test that theory. The major difference between our universe and an Einstein de Sitter universe is that our potential is evolving. It starts out its primordial value, it hits 9/10 during the matter-dominated era, and then begins to decay as lambda takes over. And this evolution affects that dipole calculation in 3 ways. It changes the Sachs-Wolfe effect, because now there's radiation present at the coupling. That means that that 1/3 is now at 0.4. Lambda increases the distance to the surface of last scattering, and that reduces the Doppler dipole relative to the Sachs-Wolfe dipole. And finally, the evolution of psi leads to an ISW effect that will partially cancel the Sachs-Wolfe anisotropy, because it will be negative. Now, we can already see the signs here are provocative.
Yes, that's right. So this is including the earlier ISW, or this is just the Sachs-Wolfe?
The calculation included earlier ISW. This kind of systematic, I'm really talking just about the late, which is the dominant at these scales. But the numerical calculation I did definitely included early ISW as well. So the signs here are provocative. We increase the Sachs-Wolfe effect and decrease the Doppler. Those two together mean that cancellation isn't going to work anymore. But the ISW effect is the right sign to continue the cancellation, if it all works out. And the answer is that, yes, indeed, it does. Again, we have our superhorizon adiabatic perturbation. And now we've got our temperature anisotropy parameterized by this delta 1 factor, which basically includes all the physics I just talked about. It was solved numerically, and it includes early ISW. And sure enough, delta 1 for the 3 cosmological parameters, omega matter, the redshift of matter radiation equality, and the redshift of decoupling, that go into this calculation, the sum of the Sachs-Wolfe and Doppler effect is always directly canceled by the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. So here's Einstein de Sitter up here at omega matter equals 1, and you can see that the Sachs-Wolfe plus Doppler cancels to 0, as does the ISW. As you dial down omega matter, that cancellation no longer occurs, but the ISW comes in and everything sums to 0. Same thing happens if you change the amount of radiation. So here I have no radiation in the blue and including radiation in the red. If you dial up the radiation, the red diverges from the blue, but they still always cancel.
And lambda CDM, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is always lambda CDM, and just the blue is has no radiation, and the red includes radiation. And it always cancels no matter what value of these parameters you pick. Absolutely. Normally, what? Right.
So how can you get a specific answer?
Oh, well, this is just the dipole from the superhorizon mode. If we are moving in our galaxy relative to the sun, relative, you know, the usual dipole, this is just the dipole from the superhorizon mode. We were worried that the superhorizon perturbation would create a dipole that would be much bigger than the one observed. And so what this is showing is that due to that superhorizon mode, there is no dipole. There could still be a dipole from our other proper motion inside the galaxy or proper motion of the galaxy, just not associated with the super horizon perturbation.
So, how do we know that subtitle that you saw on the first motion?
That's a very different dipole. So the one from our motion is a temperature dipole. It means hot versus cold. The power asymmetry is a totally different creature. It's bumpy versus smooth. So it's a change in the amplitude of the fluctuations, not a change in the mean temperature. So we see that the dipole cancels for all flat lambda CDM universes, even if radiation is included. This was shocking, at least to me. I was surprised. And so we began to wonder, we know it cancels in a universe that contains matter, radiation, and a cosmological constant. Is this a feature that's just special about matter and radiation? Is matter and radiation thermodynamically special in some way? So we tested this just by considering a toy cosmology that consisted of a cosmological constant and then some exotic fluid with some strange equation of state greater than 1/3 so that it would dominate in the early universe, keep the calculation simple. And we tested this. Does this cancel? And the answer is, yes, it does. The dipole term still cancels for adiabatic perturbations. And this led us really scratching our heads that there must be something deeper going on. So we started searching for a deeper explanation. And I must admit, I'm still not entirely thrilled with the one we came up with. But this at least is a gauge explanation for why this has to happen. There is a special synchronous gauge that for any one given observer, the metric is just a Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric plus corrections that are order k squared. This is kind of an analog to Riemann normal coordinates in GR.
So k is the wave number?
Yes, k is the wave number of the superhorizon perturbation. And since galaxies have no peculiar velocity in synchronous gauge, the world lines are freely falling particles, there's no direct dipole effect from the superhorizon mode. So that means if there's no order k perturbations in the metric, and there's no dipole, Doppler dipole, then there can be no order k perturbations in any gauge. So that at least gives some idea for why these order k cancellations are always canceling. So moving beyond the dipole.
I think that's very, very standard thing, because the curvature is really quadratic in the metric, so it has to be like
k squared.
Mm-hmm.
You can gauge it away, exactly. So for the single super horizon mode, now we're going to consider it as a sine wave because we want to go higher order in k dot x. The first order k dot x vanished. And so now we're going to the higher order, and we're going to keep the phase of our location general in this prescription. Now, we're still looking at super horizon modes, so we want kh to be much, much less than 1, which means that we can expand the temperature anisotropy in powers of k dot x, where x is the distance to decoupling. Now, we've already seen that the dipole term, the k dot x term, has vanished. We're going to decompose the rest into multipore moments. And when we're working in a frame here that's aligned with our superhorizon perturbation. Now, there is still a residual L equals 1 term here. So my language before about the dipole canceling wasn't precisely correct. It's just proportional to kx cubed instead of kx linear, which means it's comparable to the octopole moment. And due to our contamination of the dipole, due to our proper motion, the octopole is going to give us a far better constraint than this residual dipole. So the two constraints we have to worry about are the quadrupole that's induced and the octopole moment that's induced. The quadrupole is proportional to kx squared, and the octopole to kx cubed. So let's remember just briefly why we had to do this. We wanted to create a power asymmetry by inducing a long wavelength perturbation that would give us a power asymmetry. But we were worried about the temperature anisotropies that this would induce. So the quantity we really want to constrain, because it's the quantity that's related to delta phi, is the variation in psi across the observable universe. And that's just related order kx to the amplitude of the supermode and the phase. So starting with the quadrupole, again, the delta captures all the physics. It's pretty much dominated by Sachs-Wolfe effect. And the quadrupole constraint is an upper bound on delta psi that comes from the maximum allowed quadrupole m equals 0 multiple in the frame aligned with the supermode, in a frame that's aligned z equals k. Now, this is different than the observed quadrupole, because the observed quadrupole has contributions from all different perturbations, not just our single supermode. So those perturbations could conceivably wash out the contribution from our supermode. And so a conservative upper bound on what the maximum allowed quadrupole moment is from our supermode is 3 times the root mean square of the variation in the quadrupole that's been measured by WMAP. Now, a key feature of the quadrupole is it's very dependent on the phase of our location. And it vanishes if that phase is 0. If we are at the 0 point of the sine wave, then there is no quadrupole. And we can evade this constraint. We don't have to worry about it. Which means we have to move on to the octupole. The octupole would usually be a weaker constraint because it's higher order in kx. But the power with the octupole, again, it's bounded by the maximum allowed value of the octupole moment in the frame aligned with the asymmetry, is that the phase dependence of the octupole is exactly the same as the phase dependence of delta psi. And that means that the constraint it places is phase independent. We can't get out of this one by changing our location on the supermode. This one's always going to constrain us. So you might hope that we could evade this constraint by just stretching out the supermode. If we increase kx, we can satisfy this bound. That was my first idea. If we decrease kx, then we can keep this bound satisfied for any delta psi that we want. But if we want linearity beyond the horizon, if we want our supermode to be just a perturbation mode and not an indication that there's something truly bizarre going on right where we can't see, then that puts an upper bound on the variation in psi across the universe. If this is constrained to be an order unity fluctuation at most, then delta psi has to be less than kx. So these two bounds together put a rock solid bound on delta psi. And recall that our power asymmetry was directly related to the amplitude of the inflaton supermode, which is directly related to the amplitude of our potential, which means that this bound on delta psi is directly a bound on the power asymmetry to less than 1%. And you'll recall that the observed power asymmetry is 20%. So it's way too big to be explained in a way that's consistent with this constraint. And this is the bad news that I mentioned.
So you use the spectral tilt here somewhere?
The spectral tilt relates these two quantities, exactly.
So that's the reason this is so small.
That's the reason why it's so small and so suppressed.
So what do we care about?
That is more of a, it's a very good question. And believe me, it's an argument we had. It's more of an aesthetic idea. It's more of a, if we'd like this to be a superhorizon perturbation. And I'll talk a bit about where we want the superhorizon perturbation to come from later. But we do want it to be a perturbation, a single mode, and not something that has to go, you know, terribly nonlinear outside the horizon.
We just give an example. If you believe in stochastic
reflection, like,
then mm-hmm. large scales, there is a mode. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
You could perfectly well just happen to be.
And that's one alternative. And then this could work. It's kind of choose your poison. We're going to find that there's an alternative here in the curvaton model that lets you get out of this. So you can choose which model suits you best. You can keep the inflaton as the only piece during inflation, but then you've got to accept nonlinearity beyond the horizon. If you want to keep linearity beyond the horizon, you've got to go to something else besides just the inflaton. And that's going to be going to part three, the curvaton alternative. Now, the curvaton model has been around for coming up on at least 10 years now. These are just some of the major fundamental papers. There are many, many others. So to sum up what went wrong before, the problem with the inflaton model was twofold. First of all, the inflaton power is only weakly dependent. It's left at 1 minus n sub s. And that meant that a small power asymmetry requires a really large fluctuation. And because the inflaton dominates the energy density of the universe, a supermode in the inflaton field generates a huge potential perturbation. And we found that that potential perturbation was very strictly constrained by the CMB octopole. And that that constraint led directly back to a constraint on the power asymmetry with no wiggle room, with no parameters that we could twiddle with. Yeah.
So if Kerry pi was a random number, is that what you call it, Kerry, this phase factor? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if that was a random number, then I would think quantopole was a stronger constraint.
Yes, and that this is just the most lenient choice of Kerry pi, and the octopole will always kill you. If you had any other, if you weren't willing to finally put yourself right at Kerry pi equals zero, then the quadrupole would usually give you a stronger constraint. But we're saying that this model's ruled out for any choice of Kerry pi because the octopole always gets you. So we're going to solve this problem by generating the primordial fluctuations with a subdominant scalar field, the curvaton. And this helps us in both ways. First of all, we're going to see that the fluctuation to power depends much more strongly on the background value of the curvaton model than it did for the inflaton. And second, the CMB constraints on delta psi don't directly constrain the power asymmetry of the curvaton model because there's a new free parameter that enters here. Because the curvaton is only a fraction of the energy density of the universe, we can change the CMB fluctuations by dialing how much of the early universe the curvaton is. So let me briefly review the curvaton model. So the inflaton still dominates the energy density and drives inflation during inflation. The curvaton is a subdominant light scalar field. It has a very simple quadratic potential by assumption. It's light, so it oscillates, and it's subdominant. Its energy density is much, much less than the inflaton. Both the inflaton and the curvaton get quantum fluctuations during inflation of the exact same amplitude. We're going to see it's very important that the homogeneous background value of the curvaton is greater than its fluctuations. Outside the horizon, fluctuations in the curvaton and the mean value of the curvaton obey the same equation of motion. Here's the equation of motion for the background value and the perturbation. Outside the horizon, the k-squared term can be ignored. The v prime and the v double prime term actually have the same functional form because of the simple form of the potential. And that means that the ratio of the perturbation to its mean value is conserved, both during and after inflation, outside the horizon. So that's our conserved quantity. So after inflation, the curvaton still obeys the same equation of motion. As long as m is less than h, as it was during inflation, the curvaton is frozen at its initial value. But when h falls below m, the curvaton begins to oscillate at the bottom of its well. Those oscillations mean that it has zero pressure because its average kinetic energy is equal to its average potential energy. So when the curvaton oscillates, it behaves as matter. It's just rho to the a to the minus 1/3. Meanwhile, the radiation that was created by the decay of the inflaton is going as a to the minus 4. So the relative energy density of the curvaton to the inflaton is growing. So here's a numerical solution that shows this. The curvaton starts at its initial value, sigma star, falls, begins to oscillate. As it oscillates, omega curvaton begins to grow.
So do you happen to know what are the perturbations in the density?
What are
what is the alpha rho over rho of K?
I'll show that in a second. It's not up here already. It will be on the next slide. But it just comes from the potential value. And that fixes doing, that keeps fixed during the oscillation phase.
But is it like 10 to the minus 5 or 50 to the minus 5?
It could be much smaller than 10 to the minus 5. It's bounded by 10 to the minus 5 because those are the that's the observational upper bound on how much fluctuation we have. It could be smaller. So we have a curvature perturbation, the usual definition for zeta. Now, we're used to zeta being conserved outside of the horizon, but that only applies to adiabatic perturbations. And here we have a curviton isocurvature fluctuation. But the curvature fluctuation on frames of uniform density of each individual fluid, the curviton and the radiation, is still conserved. The total curvature perturbation is a combination of these two individual curvature perturbations. And you can see in the early universe, when the radiation density dominates, this term is going to dominate. But as rho sigma grows, eventually the second term will come to dominate. And so sigma zeta evolves as the relative density changes. And then finally, in the very early universe, the curviton decays into radiation. It decays when the Hubble constant is approximately equal to its decay rate, and it leaves a residual curvature perturbation determined by this R factor. And you can see from this equation, for R much, much less than 1, which is what we want, R is approximately 3/4 the ratio of the curviton energy density to the radiation density at the time of decay. So this just shows multiple trajectories for the curviton, omega curviton. It always starts at 0. Before it decays, it grows. It reaches some maximum, and then it decays to 0. The R parameter is what sets which one of these trajectories you're on. And it's the physics that goes into this is the later the decay, the higher the R value.
So I guess zeta sigma is larger than the minus 5. R is less than 1.
R is less than 1.
So that the perturbations in density of curviton is larger than 1, right?
Yes, they can be.
Because you're just asking different times.
Exactly, it's when.
Before it converts, it has to be bigger.
Yes.
But then later on, the contribution from the curviton
is bound.
It could just completely go.
It could go away.
Yes, sure.
Yeah. So R is going to be constrained by non Gaussian.
Yes, and we will get there. Absolutely. So the fluctuations in the curviton field become the curvature perturbations, as we just saw. Now we're going to look at the power spectrum. So the energy fluctuations in the curviton just come from the density itself. Remember that the ratio of these fluctuations to the mean value is always conserved outside the horizon. So we can be a little blasé about when we evaluate those quantities. Remember the quantum fluctuations. The reason why we needed the quantum fluctuations to be much smaller than the mean value is we need this term to dominate over that term. This term is Gaussian. That term is not. So we'll come back to that later. But for now, the key thing is just that the root mean squared variations have to be smaller than the mean value, so we get a Gaussian spectrum. And during matter domination, of course, the potential we've been talking about is directly related to zeta. And that gives us the power spectrum. It's going to be proportional to R squared from here. It's going to be proportional to H during inflation over the mean value during inflation squared.
Just to clarify, so your mechanism doesn't restricted just the curviton, right? So modulated reheating would do as well for your story.
Modulated reheating would do as well.
You just wanted the perturbations are generated by a second field.
We need a perturbation to be generated by a second field that's subdominant. Then yeah, maybe modified reheating would work as well.
I always thought that there are different names for the same process.
The answer turns out to be similar. There's some like parameter.
Exactly.
But the physics is quite different.
Well, it's really reheating, but just an extended reheating period, I think. Because reheating that from the end of inflation until the decay of this curve account. So that's like an extended reheating.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't think of the curvaton as part of reheating. It's decays. It's a second stage of reheating in some ways. Now, R is proportional to the energy density of the curvaton, which is in turn proportional to sigma squared. So this R squared is actually a sigma to the fourth. And we see here that the power spectrum then is proportional to the background value during inflation squared. That's a nice strong dependence, which is going to give us a nice strong asymmetry. So we have the exact same picture we did before, except now we've got the curvaton instead of the inflaton. We're going to look at the variation in the curvaton mean value across the universe. And because of this nice strong dependency, our power asymmetry is very direct and no suppression by 1 minus n sub s. It's just delta sigma over sigma bar. Sigma star is the value of the curvaton field during inflation. But remember that the perturbation ratio is always conserved. So as soon as it leaves the horizon during inflation, we can stop being as careful about when exactly we talk about being evaluated.
And the inflaton potential plays a role in fixing the sigma star?
No, the sigma star is fixed independently. The inflaton is oblivious during inflation to what sigma is doing. So sigma star is some initial condition in the universe.
And inflaton potential is completely irrelevant?
The inflaton potential is still driving inflation. So the inflaton potential, but it's not relevant to the perturbations.
Sorry, but doesn't it mean that you need like just the right number of e-folds? Because sigma star is a value initially when it's a level back, and that gets expanded.
But sigma star, since it's a light scalar field, sigma star is frozen during inflation because m is much, much smaller than h. So sigma star is frozen in its initial condition.
That's right.
And the ratio of the perturbation is frozen the minute it leaves the horizon. So there's no stretching away of anything. You don't need the right number of e-folds.
No, sorry, but maybe I'm misunderstanding. So the delta, big delta sigma,
that's not
from a quantum fluctuation. That's you really want to say different regions of space have different sigma star.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. But then that in these different batches, each of them gets expanded by either the 60. That's what.
Right. Oh, okay, yes. So it's
so
not.
It better be that you have the right number of e-folds so you see.
It's the right number of e-folds, yes, when this perturbation was created. Not necessarily the right number of e-folds of inflation itself, because this perturbation could be created during inflation, not as a quantum fluctuation, but as something else. I'll get to that at the end. Some origins of this superrising fluctuation. Oh, so I think that is the next slide. Just let me see very quick. No, it's not. Okay, then I will. So the inflaton potential is h squared over epsilon. And great. So the power from the inflaton is proportional to h squared over the slow roll parameter epsilon. The power from the curvaton is proportional to h squared over sigma bar squared. So these two quantities, it depends on which one is dominant, depends on the relationship between sigma bar and m Planck. And so you can just make.
But it's fair to say just one comment related to that. It's fair to say that normally you have to fine tune a potential to whatever one part and then the 14 so as to get them to minus 5. And here you have to do some more to drive it below.
Exactly.
This other field.
This is true.
These models are more fine tuned than just standard single field.
In some ways, but you also get.
So we're trying to the potential of the inflaton,
so that it's flat enough.
Because we're trying to get less than
it's always difficult in inflation to get a potential that's sufficiently suppressed. This one, it's bigger epsilon.
Right.
brings down the inflaton potential. So in I think that makes doesn't that make it less fine-tuned?
In fact, it's fine-tuned, but if you think of some low energy inflation, wouldn't it be more natural to have things?
Because if epsilon is larger, why is it more fine-tuned?
Exactly. I would think epsilon larger is less fine-tuned.
Yeah, but if you make epsilon larger, you have less inflation.
Oh, to get the subdivision number of E-folds, that's possible. But yeah, the basic answer to your question is that these two are kind of independent parameters. All right, and this brings me to my final part. And yeah, the lights probably, because it's kind of washed up. I don't know. There we go. Okay. So our model, the power asymmetry from the curvaton. We still have to worry about the supermode in the CMB, just like we did before. Now we have a curvaton supermode, the exact same form with some phase. The curvaton supermode generates a superhorizon potential fluctuation, just like the inflaton did. But there's two major differences that are important here. First of all, it's suppressed. There's this factor of R here. And we can make R nice and small. So we can dial down the asymmetry directly. The other feature hurts us. The potential perturbation is not sinusoidal. This is a sine wave plus the square of a sine wave. And that means that the dependence of the octopole and the quadrupole on the phase is much more complicated. So again, we're going to expand the temperature anisotropy in powers of k dot x. Now I've not even bothered to write the dipole down. But instead of a nice sine and cosine here, we've got these complicated functions of the phase of the curvaton perturbation. And in fact, there is no phase that eliminates the quadrupole for any given amplitude of the supermode. To illustrate this, I've plotted an illustrated example of just an order unity superhorizon mode and some variation across our universe of 0.2, so about the order that we'd need to get the asymmetry we see. And this is the constraint, the upper bound on R, as a function of phase. And the region in red is excluded by the quadrupole. And you can see the quadrupole is usually the most stringent constraint, except there are all these sweet spots. For this supermode, it happens at pi over 6 and 5 pi over 6, where this cancels. And those sweet spots, the blue region, the octopole excluded region, it's what's going to set your upper bound. What we decided to do, though, is we didn't want to put ourselves at the supermode that precisely. We picked the phase to be zero as a, you know, fairly average value of what this constraint is. And when you do that, you get a nice simple form for the quadrupole constraint. As I said, we're restricting ourselves now to the phase being zero. But as you can see here, most other phases give similar bounds. The nice thing about this quadrupole constraint, what makes it very different than the quadrupole constraint we saw before, is that it's no longer a direct constraint on the power asymmetry. The power asymmetry is determined by this ratio. But now we have this new free parameter R that we can dial down to evade this constraint while keeping the power asymmetry fixed. Yes. Not in the model we're just about to consider, because there's another piece. Here's the slide I was looking for. There's another parameter in this model, and that is the mixture of inflaton perturbations and curvaton perturbations. So we saw that both the inflaton and the curvaton get quantum fluctuations during inflation of the same root mean square value. The power spectrum from the inflaton is the h squared over epsilon that I sketched before. The power spectrum from the curvaton is the h squared over sigma bar squared. And so you could ask about what fraction of the curvaton, what fraction of the power comes from the curvaton over the sum of the curvaton plus the inflaton contribution. And when you look at these forms, you see that C, our new parameter, is related to a parameter I call epsilon twiddle that is proportional to epsilon. But depending on what we choose the background value of the curvaton field to be, this epsilon twiddle can either be much, much greater than 1, if sigma is much, much less than M Planck, in that case, all the fluctuations come from the curvaton. Or it can be less than or comparable to 1, to the M Planck, sorry, in which case this is going to be small and C is going to be small. The inflaton's going to dominate. Another little side note about what we're doing here. Remember that the tensor fluctuations during inflation are always smaller than the inflaton scalar fluctuations. And now we're making the inflaton scalar fluctuations smaller so that the curvaton scalar fluctuations are on top of them. And by doing that, we've pushed the tensor modes down to completely unobservable levels. And the limit that all the fluctuations come from the curvaton, C equals 1, R goes to the scalar tensor ratio goes to 0. So detection of gravity waves would be problematic for this picture. It wouldn't necessarily rule it out, but there would be tension if we ever did detect gravity waves. We'd more expect the gravity waves to be pushed down below anything we could ever hope to see.
I'm a bit confused by this problem, because there you said that the power spectrum of due to Kepler perturbations is inversely proportional to sigma bar, right?
Mm-hmm.
But here you're saying if sigma bar is a small, you have a small that the lower line there.
If sigma bar is comparable to M Planck, and this is about 1.
Oh, I see. So it's smaller, but comparable.
Right. If it's comparable, then this is not 1. This part is really small. R squared epsilon is really small. Mm-hmm. So only if this is really, really big do you get epsilon twiddle to be big. No. See, sigma bars are always less than M Planck. Okay. So finally, constraining the curvaton model. Justin's been waiting for this one, for the non-Gaussianity. So here we've got our two parameter space. We've got R and we've got C. Now I've plotted the constraints, and I'll go through the constraints in a minute, for two values of the power asymmetry, the 20% that is observed and 5% as a way to illustrate how the bounds would change. The first bound we have to worry about is the bound on our new parameter C. Because we've now diluted the power asymmetry, the inflaton is symmetric still. The curvaton is asymmetric. So if the curvaton is only a fraction of the power, then that dilutes the power asymmetry. And we don't want a greater than order unity fluctuation in the curvaton across the observable universe. Then the curvaton starts climbing up the other side of its potential well. And that doesn't buy us anything. And that puts a lower bound on C. So that rules out the yellow region here, or these two lower bounds. The quadrupole that I discussed earlier rules out the red region. And then the non-Gaussianity. So remember that the potential fluctuation is delta sigma plus delta sigma squared. So we have a Gaussian fluctuation and a Gaussian fluctuation squared. That's actually kind of nice because it lends this model to a very easy description in terms of the non-Gaussianity parameter F and L. So F and L is inversely proportional to R, and it's proportional to C squared. And we took a conservative upper bound from WMAP of 100. You can also constrain this, of course, with large-scale structure, but those bounds aren't as stringent yet. And that rules out this blue region here. Notice that this has nothing to do with the asymmetry. The blue region is the same in both plots. This is just a feature of the curvaton model itself. And so there was great rejoicing in the halls of Caltech because there was an allowed region. There is a sliver here. And remember, this is a log plot, so it's actually a pretty big sliver. But you're constrained on one hand, this ratio of R to C squared is constrained on one hand by the non-Gaussianity and constrained on the other side by the CMB quadrupole.
So Planck would completely wipe out.
Yes, the deal breaker. The window, this little window here, is shut if F and L is constrained to be less than 50. So this is a firm, concrete prediction of this model. We have to have F and L greater than 50 if we want a 20% asymmetry. So yes, Planck will see this. No, this is positive. Curvaton gives positive FNL.
Can you write down the relationship between the asymmetry and FNL, or there's more free parameters?
So the asymmetry and FNL aren't exactly at all related. That's why this blue region didn't change between the two plots. The reason why the window closes is the red, the quadrupole constraint. If you make a more stringent constraint on FNL, this blue region starts to grow. And so it grows and shuts this window here. For a smaller asymmetry, it's the quadrupole constraint. So the FNL is not related to the power asymmetry. It's the quadrupole constraint that's related to the power asymmetry.
And they are both related, but in different ways, I think. Okay, so. Those lines look very similar. That one is upper bound, the other is lower bound. So,
which two lines?
I mean, the boundaries of the boundaries of the.
Oh, the functional dependence on R over sigma c squared is the same. So that's why this window here, both the FNL and the CMB quadrupole constrain the same combination of these two parameters. But this inequality here is the FNL constraint. And you can see the power asymmetry doesn't enter there. The power asymmetry is only present in the quadrupole constraint. So some closing editorial comments on the origin of the supermode. Could the supermode be a quantum fluctuation? I know I wanted it to be. Well, we know what the observed power spectrum is. It's about 10 to the minus 9. And we know what the power from the inflaton is. And that's going to be power from the curvaton. And that's going to be some fraction c of the total power. And we can use this relationship to get an expression for delta sigma over sigma bar. And so delta sigma over sigma bar root mean squared is the quantity in parentheses here. And if we multiply that by the inverse of our power asymmetry, we find a very strong upper bound of 1/5. And what went into here, it's slightly clipped off, but a 20% power asymmetry, FNL less than 100, and our lower bound on C that we talked about before. And so that constrains this quantity to be less than 1/5. So if you cancel out the mean values, what you see is that the fluctuation in sigma across the universe has to be greater than 5 times the quantum fluctuation amplitude. The amplitude of the supermode has to be even greater still. So this would be at least a 5 sigma fluctuation. And that's highly improbable, highly undesirable. We're going to have to do better than that. So some ideas that I'd like to throw out as ways where this could come from. It could be a signature. Yeah.
These are different scales, aren't they? So this delta sigma that you're writing down there, that's on a small scale.
Mm-hmm.
And that capital delta sigma is on the super hard.
Yes.
So you cannot really directly compare the two because they're on different scales.
But what I'm saying here is if this amplitude here were a quantum fluctuation from an earlier part of inflation, if H is roughly constant during inflation. Right, so that's the hidden assumption here is if H were roughly constant during inflation, as we expect it to be, then the amplitude, you can compare the amplitude of the supermode and what would it be compared to quantum fluctuations at that same time.
I would have noticed on this budget what you're assuming is a bunch of data spectrum.
Yes.
I would have said in a different way. What you're doing is essentially starting in an excited state, which is not finished state, in which you have a coherent excitation.
Right.
As some classical field. Coherent excitation of quantum field, which looks classical.
Yes.
It's coherent state and is.
Yes.
As a dipole. And then that's just your initial state. So, and whatever reason you could have, that there could be some other new physics.
Exactly. And so those are the two ideas I wanted to put out for where this came from. It's exactly what you're saying. It could be a signature of what's called the curvaton web. This has come up by Lindy and Mukhnov, 2006, that looked at kind of the internal inflation model and came up with exactly the picture that you're describing. That if you had the curvaton starting out near its minimum, quantum fluctuations around its minimum would be a different vacuum value. You'd expect different amplitude fluctuations. You end up with these kind of cell structures of regions. Of a positive curvaton field and negative curvaton field that create kind of structure that they call the curvaton web. And nearby these walls, you end up with order unity fluctuations across in the curvaton field. So Lindy and Mukhnov, actually, I don't know if they were unaware of the observed cosmic asymmetry, but in their curvaton web paper, they mention that if our observable universe were by one of these walls, we would see different power in one direction of the sky as opposed to the other. They never connected it to the CMB.
I have a comment about that. Mm-hmm. The problem with this, we have to be careful now is the number of impulses.
Yes.
Because you are excited on clearance, like, it has stress energy. Mm-hmm. In fact, that factors that stress energy gets bigger and bigger. So if you have too many impulses of inflation, then the stress energy of that coherent state would have been bigger than the inflation.
Right, and then it would dominate, and that's...
The more inflation will wipe out this.
Right.
This feature.
Right. Which means that the other alternative is just, as you also mentioned, some pre-inflationary remnant that we can be agnostic about. That maybe this could be some sign of structure beyond the horizon.
It seems to me that you sinned, so to speak, by introducing a new degree of freedom and new parameters.
Mm-hmm.
Why not sin some more and introduce a curvaton two field with the parameters?
A curvaton what?
A curvaton two field. A second curvaton.
Okay.
A new parameter. Nature's not going to get upset. What would that do?
Well, I mean, I guess we wouldn't need that. We've got enough parameters. We have enough parameters already. We don't need another parameter. I don't know. I guess it would allow you to maybe even have some more freedom in terms of dialing which component is dominating the perturbations at given scales. And the last thing I wanted to mention, also kind of as an editorial comment, there are some indications, recent indications, that only the large scales are asymmetric. So the asymmetry was originally looked for and found in a specific L range, 5 to 40. Subsequent analyses have seen reduced asymmetry at some level for smaller scales, L greater than 100. Exactly what the upper bounds are is a little ambiguous. Different analyses give different results, but there are indications that the asymmetry is at least reduced, if not gone, at smaller scales. And so how could we make the asymmetry disappear at smaller scales? The easiest way to do this is note that the inflaton perturbations are still statistically isotropic. So if we change somehow to make the curvaton dominate on large scales and the inflaton dominate the perturbations on small scales, that would erase the asymmetry. And so two ways of doing this. The simplest way, and probably the uglier way, is to just put in a feature in the curvaton, in the inflaton potential, not the curvaton potential, the inflaton potential. As we mentioned, C is determined by epsilon, and epsilon can vary with scale. And so if you put in a feature, and it has to be a really ugly feature, in the curvaton, basically, you want to send the epsilon down, so you send the curvaton power up. That sends C down, so now the curvaton is less dependent, less important. You also... I misspoke. Inflaton power goes up, C goes down. You don't want the total power to go up, so you need to couple your drop in epsilon with a drop in V to keep the total power fixed. And so you end up with something that looks like this. It's steeper and then flat, and it has a drop in V. Yeah, that's hideous. Something that we're playing with, and this is very much work in progress, that we're hoping would be slightly less undesirable, would be to look at isocurvature modes from the inflation, from the curvaton. The curvaton gives you a fairly natural way of producing isocurvature modes. And since isocurvature perturbations naturally contribute more to the CMB power spectrum on large scales relative to small scales, there's an interesting idea is if the asymmetry could be in some isocurvature perturbation. Recall that the upper bounds on isocurvature perturbations are now at about the 10% level, which is exactly kind of the level we need the asymmetry to be at. So this is something that we are working on at the moment. So to quickly summarize, there is a power asymmetry in the CMB. It's present at the 99% confidence level, and it's detected on large scales. And we've shown that a superhorizon perturbation during inflation can generate this power asymmetry. The problem is it also generates large-scale CMB temperature perturbations. No dipole, but the quadrupole and the octupole set limits. And that's detailed in the second of the two preprints I mentioned. The inflaton perturbation is ruled out. But the curvaton perturbation is still a viable source of the observed asymmetry. And then some features of the curvaton-generated power asymmetry. I showed you that it's not a quantum fluctuation, so its origin has to be somewhat more exotic than that. It's, in the simplest picture, it's scale invariant, but it is possible to modify that if we need to. It leads to a suppressed tensor-scalar ratio. So detection of gravity waves would be somewhat problematic for this theory. Any sort of verification of the inflationary consistency relation would be even more problematic. But an even firmer and more hopeful, more imminent verification will come from Planck. This model demands a very high level of non-Gaussianity at FNL greater than 50. And Planck will be able to see that easily. So thank you very much.
Okay, questions?
Any
other? I have some more very specific questions. I mean, there is this large deviation of the algebra 2 point on the CMG. So I guess you are talking about a different.
Yes, this is the power asymmetry is totally unrelated to the abnormal quadrupole low point. It's also unrelated to the so-called axis of evil, which is an alignment of the quadrupole and the octupole. This is a different large-scale anomaly in the CMB.
Okay. Let's see. So, it has nothing to do with the cosmic variance or anything.
Well. I mean, it's at large scales. So cosmic variance is a concern, but this 99% confidence level takes into account cosmic variance and how much asymmetry you could realistically expect due to cosmic variance.
Wow. So we are over time, but other questions?
Well, I had a very nice question. So is this seen in polarization as well?
Our polarization maps are nowhere near good enough to even look for it. It would be nice to see it in polarization well. That's a signature that Planck could give. That would, whether or not it's seen in polarization well has information to give about whether or not it's foreground or primordial. Kurt Dvorkin and Wayne Hugh wrote a really nice paper a while back about the asymmetry and the signatures you'd expect to see in the polarization if it were real. So yes, the polarization has information to give about the asymmetry, but our current polarization measurements aren't useful.
So am I right in thinking that this set asymmetry is an asymmetry in the patterns of all, of those numbers of A sub L, M or something? It's not showing when you sum over M for a given L, but when you try to correlate the different M's.
No, it's actually shown when you sum. It's in the C sub L. So it's in the sums. It's in the average. It doesn't have anything to do with the M's. It's an asymmetry in the C sub L's. So the axis of evil, that alignment of the octupole and quadrupole, that's in the M's. That's the fact that the quadrupole is mostly in M equals 2, and the octupole is mostly in M equals 3, and those two planes are aligned. That's that asymmetry. This power asymmetry is present in all M's. It's just basically, if you cut the sky in half, if you just calculate the C sub L's using this part of the sky as opposed to using this part of the sky, you would get a significantly different answer.
The axis of evil is a point in that same.
No, they're not aligned. They're not. This asymmetry, remember, was for L between 5 and 40. So it's not even on the same multiples as the axis of evil. Axis of 5 and 40. L between 5 and 40.
Why is the keratin model adiabatic in the first place?
So the adiabatic comes from when it decays into radiation. So the curvatons there, it's an isocurvature perturbation, but as it comes to dominate the energy density of the universe as it's oscillating, it grows a curvature perturbation. And the idea is then it decays into radiation back when everything in the universe was still coupled to radiation. So that perturbation through the radiation gets communicated to all sectors in the same way and becomes a purely adiabatic perturbation. That's the most simple form of the curvaton decay. If the curvaton were, say, to decay after dark matter decouples, or if the curvaton were to decay into more dark matter than radiation, then you could end up with residual isocurvature modes. But in the most simple model, where the curvaton decays into radiation prior to anything decoupling, you end up with purely adiabatic. Because once again, it's just the perturbation in a single fluid, the radiation.
Played with dark, crazy dark energy things
I am not aware of any crazy dark energy things that set out to explain this. There was a crazy dark energy thing that was set out that was proposed to explain the axis of evil, some kind of super horizon asymmetric dark energy thing. And that was actually shown, I think, not to work, even for the axis of evil. I don't know of any other mechanisms. I'm only aware of one other proposal for where to get this from, and it comes from a delayed start of slow roll inflation. This is Donahue, Dutta et al. Is the only other proposal I know of for how to generate this asymmetry.
What is that crazy thing?
I was some kind of brain.
So wasn't there a recent paper by this Erickson group a few couple of months ago or so that they claim maybe a more significant detection of
that? Was a different asymmetry.
Different.
That was a quadrupolar asymmetry and not a dipole asymmetry. So a quadrupole asymmetry is the type of asymmetry you get if you have inflation with the preferred direction, like the Ackermann-Carroll-Wise model of inflation, where you have some vector during inflation that gives you a preferred direction. That gives you a quadrupolar asymmetry pattern in the CMB. And the paper you're thinking of, the Erickson et al. Group, is looking at that quadrupolar asymmetry. That one, they warn that even though it's a higher sigma detection, that group warned very strongly to take it less seriously. Because whereas there are no good explanations, and believe me, I think the WMAP group have tried to come up with them, there are no good systematic or foreground explanations for this. There is a very compelling noise explanation, a correlated noise explanation for that phenomenon, that the Erickson group was very careful to say, we think it's probably more noise than real. But it's definitely something that you should keep an eye on and see how it develops in the future.
I have one final question, but I'm not going to abuse my powers. any other question?
No. So the statement that using this imagery scale around, that statement is if you give sigma a background layer which is linear, then you make the dipole, then the effect of that on the fluctuation is still.
is scale invariant, exactly. Basically, what you're looking from this dipole sigma is you're basically saying the mean value of the curvatron is different on that side of the universe than that side of the universe. And that mean value will determine all smaller fluctuations equally. So you'd expect a scale invariant asymmetry. Unless you.
If I thought of it as just an initial giving excitation, which is safe, give any k dependence, or but you're arguing in a sense for a, that if you think of it in real space, say if there's some feature, mm-hmm. you could do a Taylor expansion, the leading term, say linear, and that still gives you a scale.
Exactly. Exactly.
So the fact that you seem to say that you see that all these asymmetries will depend away from, let's say, large L. That seems to kind of fit into what Andrew has been suggesting, that you use some computer state
that would decay away.
That will probably those two computers take a vacuum state and take in UV.
Later in inflation. That's.
Well, let's thank, if there is one more question, I guess. Yeah, it's not the question, so. Evian, so if no more questions, then let's thank her again. And so Evian is going to be here until tomorrow.
Tomorrow afternoon.
So you can find her on the third floor on the other side. Just walk by the office, you're going to find her on that corridor. Let's thank her again.